The cell was large, with rough walls and a high ceiling that had termite tracks in the coffers. Next to the only door was a full-length window, its stout bars made of lathed wood and its frame secured by an iron crosspiece. On the far wall, facing the sea, a high window was sealed by a wooden lattice. The bed was a concrete base covered by a canvas mattress filled with straw and stained with use. A built-in stone bench and a work table that also served as an altar and a washstand were beneath a solitary crucifix nailed into the wall. They left Sierra Maria there, drenched all the way to her braid and trembling with fear, in the care of a warder trained in winning the millenarian war against the demon. Sierra Maria sat down on the narrow bed, looking at the iron bars on the reinforced door, and this is how the servant found her when she brought a supper tray at 5 o'clock. The girl did not stir. The servant tried to remove her necklaces, and Sierra Maria seized her by the wrist and forced her to let them go. In the acta of the convent, which began to be recorded that night, the servant declared that a supernatural force had thrown her to the ground. The girl sat motionless while the door was closed and the chain rattled, and two turns of the key sounded in the lock. She looked at the food, a few shreds of dried meat, a piece of cassava bread, and a cup of chocolate. She bit into the cassava bread, chewed it, spit it out. She lay down on her back. She heard the gasp of the sea, the wind heavy with rain, the first thunder of the season approaching. At dawn the next day, when the servant returned with breakfast, she found the girl sleeping on the straw stuffing of the mattress she had disemboweled with her teeth and nails. At midday, she allowed herself to be led to the refectory for those who had not yet taken their reclusive vows. It was a spacious room with a high vaulted ceiling and large windows through which the brilliance of the sea came clamoring in and the uproar at the cliff sounded very close. 20 novices, most of them young, were sitting at a double row of long, rough tables. They wore ordinary serge habits, their heads were shaved, and they were cheerful and silly and did not hide the excitement of eating their barracks rations at the same table as one possessed. Sierra Maria sat near the main door, between two distracted warders, and ate almost nothing. They had dressed her in a gown like the ones worn by the novices, and in her slippers, which were still damp. No one looked at her while they ate, but when the meal was over, several novices gathered around to admire her beads. One tried to take them off. Sierra Maria went into a rage. She shoved away the warders, who attempted to subdue her, climbed onto the table and ran from one end to the other in a rampage of destruction, shrieking as if truly possessed. She broke everything in her path, then leaped through the window and wrecked the arbors in the courtyard, upset the beehives and knocked over the railings in the stables and the fences around the corrals. The bees flew away, and the animals, bellowing with panic, stampeded as far as the cloistered sleeping quarters. From then on, nothing occurred that was not attributed to the pernicious influence of Sierra Maria. Several novices declared in the acta that she flew on transparent wings that emitted a strange humming. 2 days and a squadron of slaves were needed to corral the livestock and shepherd the bees back to their honeycombs and put the house in order. Rumors circulated to the effect that the pigs had been poisoned, that the water induced prophetic visions, that one of the frightened hens flew above the rooftops and out to sea, disappearing over the horizon. But the terrors of the Clarissons were inconsistent, for despite the emotional displays of the abbess and the dread that each of them felt, Sierra Maria's cell became the focus of everyone's curiosity. Curfew in the cloister was in effect from the singing of vespers at 7 in the evening until the hour of prime and 6 o'clock mass. All lights were extinguished except those in a few authorized cells. Yet never before had life in the convent been so agitated and free. There was a traffic of shadows along the corridors, of intermittent whispers and haste held in check. They gambled in the most unexpected cells, either with Spanish decks of cards or weighted dice, and drank furtive liquors and smoked the tobacco rolled in secret ever since Josefa Miranda had forbidden it in the cloister. The presence in the convent walls of a girl possessed by demons had all the fascination of an extraordinary adventure. Even the most rigid nuns slipped out of the cloister after curfew and went in groups of two or three to talk to Sierva Maria. She greeted them with her nails, but soon learned to deal with them according to each one's personality and each night's mood. A frequent request was that she serve as their intermediary with the devil to ask for impossible favors. Sierva Maria would imitate voices from beyond the grave, voices of those who had been decapitated, voices of the spawn of Satan, and many believed her sly deceptions and attested to their truth in the actor. A band of nuns in disguise attacked the cell one evil night, gagged Sierva Maria, and stripped her of her sacred necklaces. It was an ephemeral victory. As they hurried away, the commander of the raiding party stumbled and fell on the dark stairs and fractured her skull. Her companions did not have a moment's peace until they returned the stolen necklaces to their owner. No one disturbed the knights in her cell again. For the Marquis de Casalduero, these were days of mourning. It had taken him longer to confine the girl than to repent of his action, and he suffered an attack of melancholy from which he never recovered. He spent several hours prowling around the convent, wondering at which of the countless windows Sierva Maria was thinking of him. When he returned home, he saw Bernarda in the courtyard enjoying the cool air of early evening. He was shaken by a premonition that she would ask about Sierva Maria, but she did not even look at him. He let the mastiffs out of their cages and lay down in the hammock in his bedroom, hoping to sleep forever. But he could not. The trade winds had passed, and the night was burning. The swamp sent out all kinds of insects dazed by the sweltering heat, along with clouds of carnivorous mosquitoes, and it was necessary to burn cattle dung in the bedrooms to drive them away. Souls sank into lethargy. This was the time of year when the first rainstorm was hoped for with as much longing as that with which perpetual clear weather would be prayed for 6 months later. At daybreak, the Marquis went to Abrenuncio's house. He had just sat down when he felt in advance the immense relief of sharing his sorrow. He came to the point with no preambles. "I have left the girl in Santa Clara." Abrenuncio did not understand, and the Marquis took advantage of his confusion to deliver the next blow. "She is to be exorcised," he said. The physician gave a deep sigh and said with exemplary calm, "Tell me everything." Then the Marquis told him about his visit to the bishop, his desire to pray, his blind decision, his sleepless night. It was the confession of an old Christian who did not hold back a single secret for his own enjoyment. "I am convinced it was a commandment from God," he concluded.
"You mean you have recovered your faith," said Abrenuncio.
"One never quite stops believing," said the Marquis. "Some doubt remains forever."
Abrenuncio understood. He had always thought that ceasing to believe caused a permanent scar in the place where one's faith had been, making it impossible to forget. What did seem inconceivable to him was subjecting one's child to the castigation of exorcism.
"There is not much difference between that and the witchcraft of the blacks," he said. "In fact, it is even worse, because the blacks only sacrifice roosters to their gods while the Holy Office is happy to break innocents on the rack or burn them alive in a public spectacle."
The presence of Monsignor Cayetano de Laura during the Marquis's visit with the bishop seemed a sinister precedent.
"He is an executioner," he said with no elaboration.
and then he became involved in an erudite listing of ancient autos da fe carried out against mental patients who had been executed for demonic possession or heresy. I think that killing her would have been more Christian than burying her alive, he concluded. The Marquis crossed himself. Abrinuncio looked at him, tremulous and phantasmal in his morning taffetas, and again saw in his eyes the fireflies of uncertainty that had been with him since birth. "Take her out of there," he said.
"It is what I have wanted to do since I saw her walking toward the pavilion of those interred in life," said the Marquis. "But I do not feel as if I have the strength to oppose the will of God."
"Well, start to feel as if you did," said Abrinuncio. "Perhaps God will thank you some day." That night, the Marquis requested an audience with the bishop. He wrote the letter himself in a circuitous style and a childish hand, and gave it to the porter in person to be sure it would reach its destination. The bishop was informed on Monday that Sierva Maria was ready for exorcism. He had finished his afternoon meal on the terrace with yellow bellflowers and took no special notice of the message. He ate little, but with a circumspection that could prolong the ritual for 3 hours. Sitting across from him, Father Cayetano de Laura was reading aloud in a measured voice and somewhat theatrical style. Both qualities suited the books that he chose according to his own taste and judgment. The old palace was too large for the bishop, for whom the reception room and bedroom, and the open terrace where he took his siestas and meals until the rains began, were sufficient. In the opposite wing was the official library, founded, enriched, and sustained with a master hand by Cayetano de Laura, and in its time considered one of the best in the Indies. The rest of the building consisted of 11 closed chambers where the debris of 2 centuries had accumulated. Except for the nun who served his food, Cayetano de Laura was the only person with access to the bishop's house during meals, not because of personal privilege, as some said, but because of his position as reader. He had no definite office or any title other than librarian, but he was considered a de facto vicar because of his close association with the bishop, and no one could imagine the prelate making an important decision without him. He had his own cell in an adjoining house that had interior passageways to the palace, and contained the offices and living quarters of diocesan officials and the half-dozen nuns in the bishop's domestic service. His true home, however, was the library, where he spent as many as 14 hours a day working and reading, and where he kept a campaign cot for the times he was caught off guard by sleep. The surprise on this historic afternoon was that de Laura had faltered several times in his reading, and even more unusual was that he skipped a page without realizing it and went on reading. The bishop observed him through his tiny alchemist spectacles until he turned the page. Then he interrupted, amused. "What are you thinking about?" De Laura gave a start. "It must be the heat," he said. "Why?" The bishop continued to look into his eyes. "I am sure it is something more than the heat," he said, and in the same tone he repeated, "What were you thinking about?" "The girl," said de Laura. He was not more specific, for ever since the visit of the Marquis there had been no other girl in the world as far as they were concerned. They had discussed her at length. Together they had reviewed histories of possession and the chronicles of saints who had performed exorcisms. De Laura sighed. "I dreamed about her."
"How could you dream about a person you have never seen?" asked the bishop.
"She was a little 12-year-old American-born marquisa with hair that trailed after her like a queen's mantle," he said. "How could it be anyone else?" The bishop was not a man given to celestial visions or miracles or flagellations. His kingdom was of this world, and so he nodded without conviction and continued to eat. De Laura resumed reading with more care. The bishop finished his meal, and De Laura helped him sit down in his rocking chair. When he was settled and comfortable, the bishop said,
And now, tell me the dream.
It was very simple. De Laura had dreamed that Sierra Maria sat at a window overlooking a snow-covered field, eating grapes one by one from a cluster she held in her lap. Each grape she pulled off grew back on the cluster. In the dream, it was evident that the girl had spent many years at the infinite window trying to finish the cluster, and was in no hurry to do so because she knew that in the last grape lay death. The strangest part, concluded De Laura, is that the window through which she looked at the field was the one in Salamanca, during that winter when it snowed for 3 days and the lambs suffocated in the snow. The bishop was moved. He knew and loved Cayetano De Laura too well to ignore the enigmas of his dreams. He had earned the place he occupied in the diocese and in his affections through his many talents and good character. The bishop closed his eyes to sleep the 3 minutes of his late afternoon siesta. In the meantime, De Laura ate at the same table before they said evening prayers together. He was still eating when the bishop stirred in the rocking chair and made the decision of his life.
"You take charge of the case."
He spoke without opening his eyes and emitted a lion's snore. De Laura finished his meal and sat in his usual armchair beneath the flowering vines. Then the bishop opened his eyes.
"You have not answered me."
"I thought you were talking in your sleep," said De Laura.
"Now I am saying it again when I am awake," said the bishop. "I entrust the girl's health to you."
"This is the strangest thing that has ever happened to me," said De Laura.
"Do you mean you refuse?"
"I am not an exorcist, father," said De Laura. "I do not have the character or the training or the knowledge to claim to be one. Besides, we know that God has set me on another path." It was true. Because of certain measures taken by the bishop, De Laura was one of 3 candidates for the position of curator of the Sephardic collection at the Vatican Library. But this was the first time it had been mentioned between them, although they both knew it.
"That is even more reason," said the bishop. "The girl's case, brought to a successful conclusion, may be the impetus we need."
De Laura was aware of his own awkwardness with women. To him they seemed endowed with an untransferable use of reason that allowed them to navigate without difficulty among the hazards of reality. The mere idea of an encounter, even with a defenseless child like Sierra Maria, turned the perspiration on his palms to ice. "No, senor," he decided. "I do not feel qualified."
"You not only are," replied the bishop, "but you have more than enough of what someone else would be lacking. Inspiration."
It was too great a word not to be the last. The bishop, however, did not insist on his immediate acceptance, but granted him a period of reflection until after the penance of Holy Week, which began that day.
"Go to see the girl," he said. "Make a thorough study of the case and report back to me."
This was how Cayetano Alcino del Espíritu Santo de Laura y Escudero, at the age of 36, entered the life of Sierra Maria and the history of the city. He had been the bishop's student when he held the celebrated chair of theology at Salamanca, where de Laura had graduated with highest honors. He was convinced that his father was a direct descendant of Garcilaso de la Vega, whom he held in almost religious reverence, and he did not hesitate to make this known. His mother was from San Martín de Loba, in the province of Mompox, and had emigrated to Spain with her parents. De Laura had not believed he resembled her in any way until he reached the new kingdom of Granada and recognized his hereditary nostalgia. From his first conversation with De Laura in Salamanca, Bishop de Cáceres y Virtudes had felt he was in the presence of one of those rare figures who adorned the Christianity of his time. It was a frozen February morning, and through the window one could see the snow-covered fields, and in the distance the row of poplars along the river. The wintry landscape would be the frame of a recurrent dream that was to pursue the young theologian for the rest of his life. They talked of books, of course, and the bishop could not believe that de Laura had read so much at his age. He spoke to the bishop about Garcilaso. His mentor confessed he did not know him very well, but remembered him as a pagan poet who had not mentioned God more than twice in all his work. "More times than that," said de Laura. "But during the Renaissance this was not unusual, even among good Catholics." On the day de Laura took his first vows, his mentor proposed that he accompany him to the uncertain kingdom of Yucatan, where he had just been named bishop. For de Laura, who knew life through books, the vast world of his mother seemed a dream that would never be his. While petrified lambs were being dug out of the snow, he had difficulty imagining the oppressive heat, the eternal stink of carrion, the steaming swamps. For the bishop, who had fought in the African wars, it was easier to conceive of them. "I have heard that our clerics go mad with joy in the Indies," said de Laura.
"And some hang themselves," said the bishop. "It is a kingdom menaced by sodomy, idolatry, and anthropophagy."
And he added without bias,
"Like the land of the Moors."
But he also thought that this was its greatest attraction. There was a need for warriors as capable of imposing the gifts of Christian civilization as of preaching in the desert. At the age of 23, however, de Laura believed that his road to the right hand of the Holy Spirit, toward whom he felt absolute devotion, had already been decided. "All my life I have dreamed of being a chief librarian," he said. "It is the only work I am fit for." He had taken part in the public examinations for a position in Toledo that would be the first step toward realizing his dream, and he was certain he would receive the appointment. But his mentor was obstinate. "It is easier to become a saint as a librarian in Yucatan than as a martyr in Toledo," he said. De Laura replied with no humility. "If God is willing, I would rather be an angel than a saint." He was still thinking over his mentor's offer when he was named to the post in Toledo, but he chose Yucatan instead. De Laura and the bishop never arrived, however. They were shipwrecked in the Windward Passage after 70 days of rough seas, and were rescued by a battered convoy that abandoned them to their fate at Santa Maria la Antigua in Darien. They spent more than a year there, waiting for the illusory mails carried by the galleon fleet, until de Cáceres was named interim bishop of these lands whose see was left vacant at the sudden death of the titular bishop. When he saw the colossal jungle of Uraba from the small vessel carrying them to their new destination, de Laura recognized the nostalgia that had tormented his mother during the lugubrious winters of Toledo. The hallucinatory twilights, the nightmarish birds, the exquisite putrefactions of the mangrove swamps seemed the cherished memories of a past he had not lived. "Only the Holy Spirit could have arranged things so well and brought me to the land of my mother," he said. 12 years later, the bishop had renounced the dream of Yucatan. He had lived a full 73 years, he was dying of asthma, and he knew he would never again watch the snow fall in Salamanca. At the time Sierva Maria entered the convent, he had decided to retire once he had smoothed the road to Rome for his disciple. The next day, Cayetano de Laura went to the convent of Santa Clara. Despite the heat, he wore a habit of raw wool and carried a flask of holy water and a casket of sacramental oils, primary weapons in the war against the demon. The abbess had never seen him, but talk of his intelligence and power had penetrated the silence of the cloister. When she received him in the locutory at 6 in the morning, she was struck by his air of youth, his pallor worthy of a martyr, the timbre of his voice, and the enigma of his lock of white hair. But no virtue would have been enough to make her forget that he was the soldier of the bishop. All that de Laura noticed, though, was the clamorous crowing of the roosters.
There are only 6 of them, but they make enough noise for 100, said the abbess. Furthermore, a pig spoke and a goat gave birth to triplets. And she added with fervour, everything has been like this since your bishop did us the favour of sending us his poisoned gift. She viewed with equal alarm the garden flowering with so much vigour that it seemed contra natura. As they walked across it, she pointed out to De Laura that there were flowers of exceptional size and colour, some with an unbearable scent. As far as she was concerned, everything ordinary had something supernatural about it. With each word, De Laura felt she was stronger than he, and he hastened to sharpen his weapons. "We have not said that the girl is possessed," he said, "but only that there are reasons to suspect it." "What we are witnessing speaks for itself," said the abbess. "Take care," said De Laura. "Sometimes we attribute certain things we do not understand to the demon, not thinking they may be things of God that we do not understand." "Saint Thomas said it, and I will be guided by him," said the abbess. "One must not believe demons, even when they speak the truth." The cloistered silence began on the second floor. On one side were the empty cells locked and bolted during the day, and facing them was a row of windows open to the splendour of the sea. The novices did not seem to be distracted from their labours, but in reality they followed every move of the abbess and her visitor as they made their way toward the prison pavilion. Before they came to the far end of the corridor, where Sierra Maria was confined, they passed the cell of Martina Laborde, a former nun condemned to life imprisonment for having murdered 2 of her companions with a carving knife. She never confessed her motive. She had spent 11 years there and was better known for her failed escape attempts than for her crime. She never accepted that being in prison for life was the same as being a cloistered nun, and in this she was so consistent that she had offered to serve the rest of her sentence as a maid in the pavilion of those interred in life. Her implacable obsession, to which she devoted the same zeal she brought to her faith, was to be free, even if she had to kill again. De Laura could not resist his rather puerile curiosity and peered into the cell through the iron bars at the window. Martina's back was to him. When she sensed someone looking at her, she turned toward the door, and De Laura felt at once the power of her charm. An uneasy abbess moved him away from the window. "Take care," she said. "That creature is capable of anything." "So much a threat even behind bars," said De Laura. "That much and more," said the abbess. "If it were up to me, she would have been released long ago. The perturbation she causes is too great for this convent." When the warder opened the door, Sierra Maria's cell exhaled a breath of decay. The girl lay on her back on the stone bed with no mattress, her feet and hands bound with leather straps. She seemed dead, but her eyes held the light of the sea. De Laura thought she was identical to the girl in his dream, and a tremor took control of his body and soaked him in icy perspiration. He closed his eyes and prayed in a low voice, with all the weight of his faith, and when he finished he had regained his composure. "Even if she were not possessed by any demon," he said, "this poor creature is in the most propitious environment for becoming so." The abbess replied, "This is an honour we do not deserve." For they had done everything to keep the cell in the best condition, yet Sierra Maria generated her own dung heap. "Our war is not against her, but against the demons who may inhabit her," said De Laura. He entered on tiptoe to avoid the filth on the floor and sprinkled the cell with the hyssop of holy water, murmuring the ritual formulas. The abbess was terrified by the stains of water left on the walls. "Blood!" she screamed. De Laura challenged the frivolity of her reasoning. "Just because the water was red, that did not mean it had to be blood, and even if it were, that did not mean it had to be diabolical. It would be more reasonable to assume this is a miracle, and that power belongs only to God," he said. It was neither one thing nor the other, however, for when the spots dried on the whitewashed walls, they had changed from red to an intense green. The abbess blushed.
Not only the Clarissans, but all the women of her day were forbidden any kind of formal education. Yet from the time she was very young, she had learned scholastic argumentation in her family of distinguished theologians and great heretics. "At least," she replied, "let us not deny to demons the simple power to change the color of blood." "Nothing is more useful than a timely doubt," was De Laura's immediate retort, and he looked straight at her. "Read St. Augustine." "I have already read him with great care," said the abbess. "Well, read him again," said De Laura. Before turning his attention to the girl, he asked the warder in a very courteous tone to leave the cell. Then, without the same sweetness, he said to the abbess, "You too, please." "On your responsibility," she said. "The bishop is the highest authority," he said. "There is no need to remind me of that," said the abbess with a touch of sarcasm. "We know by now that you are the masters of God." De Laura granted her the pleasure of the last word. He sat on the edge of the bed and examined the girl with the thoroughness of a physician. He continued to tremble, but no longer perspired. Seen at close quarters, Sierra Maria was scratched and bruised, and her skin was chafed raw by the straps. But what affected him most was the wound on her ankle, inflamed and festering because of the healer's ineptitude. As he examined her, De Laura explained that she had not been brought there to be martyrized, but because of the suspicion that a demon had entered her body in order to steal her soul. He needed her help to establish the truth, but it was impossible to know if she was listening and if she understood that it was a plea from the heart. When he had completed the examination, De Laura requested a chest of medicines, but did not permit the apothecary nun to enter the cell. He applied balsams to the girl's wounds, and with gentle breaths relieved the burning on her raw skin, astounded at her tolerance of pain. Sierra Maria answered none of his questions, showed no interest in his preaching, and complained about nothing. It was a discouraging start that pursued De Laura until he reached the calm waters of the library. The largest room in the bishop's house, it did not have a single window, and the walls were lined with glass-doored mahogany cabinets containing numerous books arranged in careful order. In the center of the room stood a large table that held maritime charts, an astrolabe and other navigational instruments, and a globe of the earth with additions and emendations that successive cartographers had made by hand as the size of the world increased. In the rear was a rustic work table with an inkwell, penknife, turkey quills for writing, sand to dry the ink, and a withered carnation in a vase. The entire room was in shadow and had the odor of paper at rest and the coolness and peace of a forest glade. In a smaller enclosure at the back of the room, there was a locked cabinet with doors made of ordinary lumber. This was the prison of forbidden books, purged by the Holy Inquisition because they dealt with deceptive and profane matters and false histories. No one had access to it but Cayetano de Laura, who had pontifical permission to explore the abysses of written works gone astray. From the moment he first saw Sierra Maria, those calm waters of so many years became his inferno. He would not meet there again with his friends the clergy and laymen who shared with him the delight of pure ideas and organized scholastic tourneys, literary gatherings, musical evenings. His passion was reduced to understanding the wily deceptions of the demon, and for 5 days and nights he devoted all his reading and reflection to the subject before he returned to the convent. On Monday, when the bishop saw him leave with a firm step, he asked him how he felt. "As if I had the wings of the Holy Spirit," said De Laura. He had put on his cassock of ordinary cotton, which filled him with the courage of a woodcutter, and his soul wore armor against despair. They stood him in good stead. The warder responded to his greeting with a grunt. Sierra Maria received him with an ill-tempered frown, and it was difficult to breathe in the cell because the excrement and the remains of earlier meals were strewn over the floor. On the altar, next to the sanctuary lamp, the midday meal lay untouched. De Laura picked up the plate and offered the girl a spoonful of black beans in coagulated grease. She turned her head. He insisted several times, but her response was always the same. Then De Laura put the spoonful of beans in his mouth, tasted it, and swallowed without chewing, showing real signs of repugnance. "You're right," he told her. "This is vile." The girl did not pay the slightest attention to him. When he treated her inflamed ankle, the skin twitched and her eyes filled with tears. He thought she had surrendered, and he comforted her with the murmurings of a good shepherd, and at last dared loosen the straps to give her ravaged body some respite. The girl flexed her fingers several times to feel if they were still hers and stretched her feet, numbed by the bindings. Then she looked at De Laura for the first time, weighed and measured him, and attacked with the well-aimed pounce of a hunted animal. The warder helped subdue her and tighten the straps again. Before he left, De Laura took a sandalwood rosary from his pocket and hung it around Sierra Maria's neck over her Santeria beads. The bishop was alarmed when he saw him return with scratches on his face and a bite on his hand, the mere sight of which caused him distress. But he was even more alarmed by De Laura's reaction. He displayed his wounds as if they were battle trophies and scoffed at the danger of contracting rabies. The bishop's physician, however, treated them with utmost seriousness, for he was one of those who feared that the eclipse on the following Monday would be the prelude to grave disasters. On the other hand, the murderer Martina Laborde did not encounter the least resistance in Sierra Maria. She had tiptoed to her cell as if by chance, and seen her in the bed tied by her feet and hands. The girl went on the defensive and kept her eyes fixed and alert until Martina smiled. Then she smiled too, and her surrender was unconditional. It was as if the soul of Dominga de Adviento had filled the entire cell. Martina told her who she was and why she was there for the rest of her days, even though she had grown hoarse proclaiming her innocence. When Martina asked Sierra Maria the reasons for her confinement, she could tell her only the little she had learned from her exorcist. "I have a devil inside." Martina asked no more questions, assuming that the girl lied or had been lied to, not knowing she was one of the few white women to whom Sierra Maria had told the truth. She gave her a demonstration of the art of embroidery, and the girl asked to be freed so that she could try it too. Martina showed her the scissors she carried in the pocket of her gown, along with the other items used for needlework. "What you want is for me to free you," she said. "But I warn you, if you try to hurt me, I have the means to kill you." Sierra Maria did not doubt her determination. She was freed, and she repeated the embroidery lesson with the facility and good ear with which she had learned to play the thierbo. Before Martina left, she promised to obtain permission for them to watch the total eclipse of the sun together on the following Monday. At dawn on Friday, the swallows took their leave, making a wide circle in the sky and showering the streets and rooftops with a foul-smelling indigo snowstorm. It was difficult to eat and sleep until the midday sun dried the stubborn droppings and the night breezes purified the air. But terror prevailed. No one had ever seen swallows shit in mid-flight or heard of the stink of their excrement interfering with ordinary life. In the convent, of course, no one doubted that Sierra Maria had the power to change the laws of migration. On Sunday after Mass, De Laura could even feel the hardness in the air as he crossed the garden with a little basket of pastries from the arcades. Sierra Maria, remote from everything, still wore the rosary round her neck, but she did not respond to his greeting or deign to look at him. He sat beside her, chewed a cruller from the basket with delight, and said with his mouth full,
"Tastes like heaven."
He brought the other half of the cruller to Sierra Maria's mouth. She turned her head, not facing the wall as she had on other occasions, but indicating to De Laura that the warder was spying on them. He made an emphatic gesture with his hand in the direction of the door.
"Get away from there," he ordered.
When the warder moved away, The girl tried to satisfy her long-standing hunger with half the cruller, but spat out the piece she had bitten off.
"Tastes like swallow shit," she said.
Still, her humour changed. She cooperated when Delaura treated the painful raw spots on her back and paid attention to him for the first time when she saw his bandaged hand. With an innocence that could not be feigned, she asked what had happened.
"I was bitten by a little rabid dog with a tail more than a metre long."
Sierva Maria wanted to see the wound. Delaura removed the bandage, and with her index finger she touched the crimson halo of the swelling as if it were a burning coal, and laughed for the first time.
"I'm worse than the plague," she said.
Delaura responded not with the Gospels, but with Garcilaso.
"Well may you do this to one who can endure it."
He burned with the revelation that something immense and irreparable had begun to occur in his life. When he left, the warder reminded him on behalf of the abbess that it was forbidden to bring in provisions from the street because of the danger that the food might be poisoned, as it had been during the siege. Delaura lied and said he had brought the basket with the permission of the bishop, and lodged a formal complaint about the bad food served to those confined in a convent famous for its fine cuisine. During supper he read to the bishop with renewed enthusiasm. As always, he joined him in the evening prayers, closing his eyes to make it easier to think of Sierva Maria as he prayed. He retired to the library earlier than usual, thinking of her, and the more he thought, the stronger grew his desire to think. He recited aloud the love sonnets of Garcilaso, torn by the suspicion that every verse contained an enigmatic portent that had something to do with his life. He could not sleep. At dawn he was slumped over the desk, his forehead pressing against the book he had not read. From the depths of sleep he heard the three nocturnes of the New Day's Matins in the adjacent sanctuary.
"God save you, Maria de todos los ángeles," he said in his sleep.
His own voice startled him awake, and in her inmate's tunic, with her fiery hair spilling over her shoulders, he saw Sierva Maria discard the old carnation and place a bouquet of newly opened gardenias in the vase on his work table. Delaura, with Garcilaso, told her in an ardent voice,
"For you I was born, for you do I have life, for you will I die, for you am I now dying."
Sierva Maria smiled without looking at him. He closed his eyes to be sure that she was not an illusion of the shadows. When he opened them, the vision had disappeared, but the library was saturated with the scent of her gardenias.